Howdy. I'm John Junkins. If you haven't met me before, I'm the director of the Hagler Institute for Advanced Study. Each semester, we have one special speaker that is designated the Hagler Eminent Scholar Lecturer, and this is the spring 2019 Eminent Scholar Lecture. Our speaker is a Hagler faculty fellow who has about finished her term here. She's from Duke University. She's among the most cited mathematicians in the world. She is regarded for her study of wavelets primarily, and one particular class of wavelets are known as the Dabashi's wavelets. And these are integrated into a JPEG image compression, among other things, many other things. Her 1992 monograph entitled 10 Lectures on Wavelets is among the top papers in this field. It's a classic in this field. It has mid-20,000 citations. She received her bachelor's degree in physics in 1975 and her doctorate in theoretical physics in 1980. Both in Belgium, and I'm sure I'll butcher the name of the university, the Vrije Universiteit of Brussels, where she became a research professor in 1984. She then left academia and joined AT&T Bell Labs in Murray Hill, New Jersey, and was there for a while. And in the early 90s, 1991, she moved to Rutgers as a professor in the Department of Mathematics. She subsequently, 3 years later, joined Princeton University as professor in the Department of Mathematics and the program in Applied and Computational Mathematics. And in 2004, she became the William R. Keenan Professor. In 2011, she migrated south and went to Duke University, her current zip code, as the James P. Duke Professor of Mathematics. She is extremely well honored in terms of prizes from around the world. She received the Belgium's Louis Impine Prize in Physics. She has a MacArthur, has had a MacArthur Fellowship. She won the American Mathematical Society Steele Prize in 2011, the American Mathematical Society's Ruth Little Sater Prize. She won from the National Academy of Sciences the Medal in Mathematics. She won the Gold Medal of the Flemish Royal Academy of Arts and Sciences. She's held a Guggenheim Fellowship. She won the Benjamin Franklin Medal for Electrical Engineering and the Booker Gold Medal of the International Union of Radio Engineers. And finally, the James Kilby Medal of the IEEE Signal Processing Society. She's extraordinarily well recognized, and amazingly, once you get acquainted with her, given her level of confidence, she's amazingly accessible and humble. It's my great pleasure to introduce to you Ingrid Dabashi's.
Well, thank you. And it's a great pleasure to be here. It was a pleasure to be here as a Hagler Fellow in the fall. I had a great time working with colleagues in the math department, and I'm very happy to be here to give this lecture now. So the lecture is on a direction in which I have been working I've other projects that work with biologists and in applied mathematics and with engineers. This is a project where I work with art historians and art curators. And so I'd like to tell you about that intellectual adventure and things that happen that are mathematically important and that have been done, some not by me, and then I'll talk about my own work. So I have first a couple of examples of lectures of work that has been done by others than myself. And the first one is work on restoration of frescoes by Mantegna in the Eremitani Church in Padua. So a later subject is by Rick Johnson, together with collaborators, some of whom are here, are in Texas, not here at Texas A&M, but at Rice University. Finally, I'll talk about a project with which I was involved. So Massimo Fornasier, while he was still a graduate student, actually, worked on the reconstruction of frescoes of the Eremitani Church. This is a photograph of the church as it is now after reconstruction. This is how it looked like after the Second World War. In the final days of the war, when the theater of war was in Italy, it was bombed by mistake. It was mistaken for a military target. And fantastic frescoes that existed throughout the church, this is a virtual reconstruction, as is this, were completely destroyed. I mean, in this reconstruction, actually the bottom two frescoes are the true frescoes. They actually had been removed from the church because of water damage and so survived the bombing. The other ones, which were much better because water hadn't reached that high, were all reduced to fragments of this type, of which many, many, many boxes were collected immediately after the bombing and trucked to the center of restoration of antiquities in Rome, where every so often conservators would open the boxes and give up the task as impossible and close them again. So in the 90s, people had done tremendous advances in computing, but remember, this is a period when supercomputers could do less than the phone in your pockets now. So all these fragments were photographed, photographed on the front and the back, and high-resolution versions were put on CD-ROMs. Do you remember these things? Some of you probably don't even remember because you were born after. They asked them for proposals to try to reconstruct the frescoes from them. Now, it was an incredible task because there were a very large number of fragments. The fragments were each maybe a square inch on average. They knew that they only had fragments for about 10% of the whole surface, actually less than that, it turned out. And they had high quality photographs of the frescoes, which of course were in black and white and which had been taken with parallax, but they could correct for that because they knew the exact dimensions. So they had, it's like having a gigantic jigsaw puzzle, of which the puzzle pieces have arbitrary sides, so you can't know, you don't know the orientation of the piece. Not only don't you know where, but you don't know the orientation. You only have 10%, but you do have the cover of the box in black and white. And so the idea was try to put all these pieces in place. And Massimo Fornasier came up with an approach that could be handled by the computing methods of that time, and that was then implemented. And it was based on the fact that images, when you digitize them, become arrays of numbers. And so with these arrays of numbers, you can compute things. And so computations, image processing, digital image processing, was what his methods was based on. And so when you digitize an image, you get these pixels, which we are familiar with our television screens. And if let's think in gray level for the moment. I mean, of course, we do have color, but the photographs they have were in gray level anyway. And you digitize them, and each pixel is assigned a number that indicates 0 when it's all black, 255 when it's, if you have an 8-bit image, when it's all white, and then in between you have these 254 levels of gray, not 50 that other people have. But but of course we don't know the orientation. And so it's not as easy as just thinking, let me look at the numbers and see where I have seen the same array of numbers. Because if you rotate an image, then the pixel representation you get is completely different. So he had to find a way of representing the images that took into account that you had this circular unknown. And so what he proposed was that images, that on every thing you would take a circle that had content, if your fragment of fresco was uniform in color, there was no hope of finding where it had belonged. But if it had features or something, so it, then you could take a circle, the maximum circle that had such content, and decompose that into circular harmonics. And here are examples of such circular harmonics that are shown. And so if you use these circular harmonics, you can decompose. Here's an example where one after another harmonics are added, and you see that as you take in more and more of the harmonics, the features of the image start adding up, so that you start recognizing the elements. So why doing the circular harmonics? Well, because they have this this fantastic symmetry. We know exactly what happens to one of these when you rotate it. And in fact, so you take your original image, you can decompose it into these different harmonics, and with they have certain coefficients. You take 1/3 of this and then 1/12 of that and so on. And when you rotate each one of them, you know exactly what happens to it as it rotates. Actually, it stays the same function, it gets multiplied with a complex phase factor. But so we know exactly and very easily what happens. And so when you have the fragment, you decompose it, you look at the coefficients. And then you can look at a circle over your whole fresco and its decomposition, and you can easily compare that with all possible rotated versions of the one you present very fast, and so you can find out what the big hits are. And so that's what happened. They set together in the early noughts, they set together this lab where people could come volunteer, and they would, we're still at a time when even very powerful computers could do very little. You see, have you remember those terminals? So they would take a fragment out of the collection. They would then on that find the biggest circle you could put on. And then it would ask to check everything that was in memory, all these black and white pictures with circles of that dimension. And they would, it would then answer by giving top hits. In this particular case, the top hit is the right one, but it gives other hits where there are also several closed space lines. You see they're fairly parallel, and some there's a wide and a smaller spacing, a wide and a smaller spacing, so it could correspond to a column or to something on this fruit depiction. But typically, it would give, among the top five hits, would be the right one. And paradoxically enough, the art conservators, the curators, were liked it, that there was, it was not a completely automated process, that it took in some human decision. And that is something that's actually a lesson for many things that we do. And often it is not worth trying to make the much more difficult and completely automatical thing in situations where a decision, a medical or an art conservation decision is necessary. It's good to try to do something and easier, something that still, for very critical parts, requires a human element in it, because it gives more control to the art conservators or art historians. But so what happened is that they could, here you see one of those frescoes and a lot of the fragments put in place. Here, actually, on another fresco where we are now going to look at several details. So here you see these elements are put in place, or a little lower, these. Yet elsewhere, we have this. You can ask yourself, well, what is the good of that, of knowing where all these elements are? Well, then they could start on the next stage, which is really an enormous in-painting project. If you look at this, you see that you have, for this fragment, you now know the color scheme for the floor, the tiled floor. You know the color scheme for the toes, for the lance haft, for the leather protection leggings on the soldier, and so on. So with a little bit of color information, but distributed over the whole image, you can actually reconstruct color everywhere. And here you see what was done in the reconstruction. Yes, here you see actually one of this a photograph taken during the reconstruction in the church. The conservators decided that they would, in some places, in paint, so show the color, but with a slight difference, more pastel than saturated colors, to make people, to make clear what was reconstructed and what was original. It's a very traditional approach. In some places, they would just leave the black and white information as to illustrate what they used to reconstruct. And so here, the whole church now has been, all the pieces of fresco have been put in place, and you can get an impression now of what everything was. But you could also have done this virtually. I mean, when people do in painting, the in painting that we saw earlier had been done by hand, but what they do is they look at the color information and they propagate it further and so on. And for that we have excellent algorithms. We can use algorithms from fluid mechanics actually to do that propagation. And so in this thing, you would slowly propagate until you had the whole thing colorized, since you have the black and white information. So for this, as you can see it in the church, you could put also, if you did it full saturation, and with these algorithms you get this. And now Massimo is working with people in Padua to actually put in now that we do have these powerful cell phones, to put in place an app where people could watch the fresco as it is, and then watch that fragment of fresco in full color, and they could see virtually how it would have been. And so that's one example where a tool of mathematics that was well known, namely this decomposition circular harmonics, served with the computational methods of that time to make this possible. Another application, the work of thread counts for paintings on canvas. Rick Johnson is an electrical engineer at Cornell University, who from his student days was interested in both signal processing. He's actually, his career was on audio rather than image processing, and digital signal processing anyway. And he also, since he had a minor in art conservation when he was a graduate student. So during a sabbatical in about 15 years ago, he got in Europe, he got to know people at the Van Gogh Museum, and he was very impressed with how much science they use in their approaches in studying the paintings at the Van Gogh Museum or at any museum. X-rays, infrared, now they use X-ray fluorescence and so on. So, but he said that he was surprised how little image recognition or image processing was used. And they said, well, why would we? We are very highly trained visual experts, and they are. And he said, well, there's a lot that can be done with image processing, more than you might think. Actually, he is the person who got me into this field. He brokered a workshop with the people from the Van Gogh Museum in 2008, I believe, where he said, look, I'll try to convince people who work on image and image analysis to come if you make it possible for them to work on high-resolution data of scans of these Van Gogh paintings. At the time, and still now, many museums were very kept digital information on the paintings in their collection very close to their vest. They wouldn't share those. Even now, it's hard to get very high-resolution data. I mean, the ones that you get on the web are typically not high-resolution enough to do serious processing with. But at that time, it was impossible even to get low resolution. But he brokered, and we had to sign contracts in which we would lose our souls if ever these things leaked. And they haven't leaked, not for me anyway. And so that we would get these data to work with, and that was the attraction for us, and for them it was to see what we could do. And so they had given us some tasks, and I'll come back to that. But what happened in this whole thing is that, and that has happened also always during my whole experience in all interdisciplinary projects actually, not just with the art conservators, as you engage with a community other than your own, but which might have problems to which your expertise can apply, you start to learn about many more other problems that they don't even think of telling you, and where you can see how you could be useful. So one thing that happened was that Rick Johnson heard from Ella Hendricks at the Van Gogh Museum about the effort to write a catalogue raisonné of the Van Gogh. So that's a catalogue in which they write about every painting in the collection, every single thing that is known. I mean, so scientifically, a paint, whatever, whatever, all the information in one place. So it's a very big collection. And he learned that one of those items that are set, are given in these collections are thread counts. These are paintings on canvas, and a canvas is completely characterized, well, not completely, but one of the characteristics is how many threads are used in the weft and the weave of the canvas. And so these were numbers. And the way they would get these numbers is that they would look at them through a microscope and they would count and say so many threads per inch, horizontally, vertically. They would do that in a number of spots until they were completely glazed over and bored. And he said, but you know, instead of doing it in 10 spots, we could try to automate this. I mean, all you need to do is take little pieces and then take a Fourier transform. And of course, it's not exactly horizontal and vertical. So what happens is that you take a little, so let me show you. Here's one Van Gogh painting. How do you see these threads? You see them actually in the X-rays. This is an X-ray, a corner of that painting. Now, why would you see the threads in the X-ray? I mean, because the threads themselves are completely impervious to the X-rays. I mean, why would they show up? Well, you don't really see the threads. What you see is the trace left in the layer of primer of the threads. So canvases are primed with a bottom color, a bottom layer, so that they will absorb the paint, the costly paint that you go into apply on them much, much less faster. So you don't need to use as much paint and you're more flexible. That ground layer, until sometime in the 20th century when they decided it was too dangerous, used to be prepared with lead white. And so it has a lot of lead in it. And lead, of course, does show up in X-rays. And on this canvas, if you look at it closely, it has these valleys and mountains where you have a thread and you're between threads. And so the primer would be slightly thicker between threads than on top of a thread. And these differences in thickness show you the thread structure. And that's why you see the thread structure, or if you take it in negative, it shows up even, which is usually how they look at it to do thread counts. You see the thread structure very, very clearly. So even paintings in which, because canvas also is not, the threads decay under the chemical influence of all the paints on top of it. And so very old paintings have canvas in very poor condition. Sometimes the threads have disappeared altogether and are relined. I mean, so that means that at some stage, somebody put a much more solid piece of canvas behind it, glued it to the back to give it much more structural integrity. So you can't see the canvas by just turning it over and taking a photograph. I mean, and even cases where they have removed the remainders of the threads and then put another canvas on back, you still see the original canvas in the lead white. The threads are gone. But anyway, so that's how you can count it. And here is the one where you very clearly see that the threads are not always horizontal and vertical. This is one where the deviation is very large, but because the primer renders the canvas very stiff. And once it's primed, you cannot hope if it there was bends in the weft when you primed it to straighten it out again. You can straighten out that full thing, but the threads have their bend structure still in it. And you have this now solid thing that you frame on the wood frame. Okay, so when you do this Fourier transform of little pieces, what you will see is in which directions you have you see the frequency of how periodic it is in different directions, and you can find what the directions of the thread, because in that direction, the distance between subsequent features is the smallest. And if you think of something layered like that, it's also regular at an angle, but the distance between threads is larger. So where the distance is smallest, the frequency highest, is where you see the direction. You can find that way not only the frequency, so how many threads per inch, but also at what angle with the horizontal and vertical they are. And so what Rick Johnson did, he used what you see, the typical visualization colors of MATLAB. He would, for each painting, actually make a map like that, putting together little mosaics of little fragments, that would give you by color the density of the threads, which is not, these were still hand-woven cloths, so it's not uniform throughout, and also the deviation from the ideal angle, vertical or horizontal. So you would get four maps. Here I've given it for density for the horizontal threads and for deviation of angle for the vertical threads. So you would get these four color maps. And then something happened that had not been foreseen. They realized that they now had a whole map for the whole painting, and so they could recognize that that map was the same in some paintings as in others, because these were roll mates. What happened is that Van Gogh, like many painters, would buy big stretches of fabric, primed fabric, and then cut it to pieces, because it was much cheaper than to prepare to buy separate paintings. And so these are clearly roll mates. You see the same pattern. These are paintings that we now know were organized like that on a roll of fabric, because this is one pattern and this is the other. And so that is sufficient to place them together. Now, this has had unintended consequences. Well, unintended from the start. Nobody had thought of it that way. For instance, there's a painting by Velázquez that has been reattributed to Velázquez. It had been deattributed because they thought, well, it's not as high quality as the others, I mean, and so on. Probably was school of, or. But then they found that it was a role mate of other paintings by Velázquez that were undoubtedly by the great master. And he didn't share his more expensive fabric canvas with his students. I mean, it was just the master on a less good day. I mean, of course, it doesn't change a thing to the painting. I mean, it changes a lot to its insurance price, however. But so this is, again, a place where mathematical way of thinking and analyzing the data led to, and then as soon as people have a tool, they use it in other ways than they originally thought they would use it. Well, that's what we all are, right? It's the creativity of humanity. I mean, the next project I want to talk about will be the rejuvenation and aging of a medieval panel that are in the North Carolina Museum of Art collection. But let me tell you a little bit about what tools are that I use. So I told you already that Rick Johnson was the one who got me into this whole endeavor. And the Van Gogh Museum, for that first workshop where people came together, wanted to give us some challenges. I mean, so show us what you can do, and show us in particular with respect to this and this. And in fact, of all the projects I've worked on, it may be my least favorite, because it was the beginning and people didn't know yet what we could do. But so they asked us to look, could we characterize style in some way, and how would we do it, and could we learn to distinguish originals from copies? So I used, in order to do this, the image processing tools that I know best, which use wavelets. Okay, so let me try. I was asked to prepare a public lecture, so I'm not assuming technical knowledge. I know for some of you what I'm going to say is baby stuff, but still, please. I had a colleague at Bell Labs who said, everybody says the picture is worth 1,000 words. He says, and that's true, he says, but only if you have the 1,000 words. So even though I'm going to show you pictures, I do assure you I have the thousands of words, and I can tell them to you afterwards if you want. Okay, so what you do when you do a wavelet decomposition, a representation by wavelets of an image, is you peel it apart into several layers that have to do with different resolutions. And one way of thinking of that is you could think that you take your image and you blur it slightly. Now remember, all these things are arrays of numbers. You've changed the image, the numbers will be different. You could subtract the two, one from the other. And if you do that, you can try to render that difference, which is also a ratio of numbers, again as a picture. And so here you see that difference, you don't see much, I'm going to enhance it. And what you see is that I see something, so white in this way of representing it means nothing, but black means, I see something where I had sharp lines, sharp edges. And again, that's logical because by blurring I've made the edges less sharp, and so those are the places where I see a difference. So it's essentially an edge detector. But so I can do this. I can now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to do this several times, but to illustrate it I'm going to take a little piece, although you should imagine it on the full painting. So I take this tiny little piece, I enlarge it here. If I blur it, and blur it again, and blur it again, I have every time lost some information. I can look at successive differences, and even though this is a black and white image, oh yes, that first workshop on Van Gogh, we worked with only black and white images, because despite signing all these contracts about how we were never, ever, ever going to share those data, they still didn't quite trust us. So we got, they figured that nobody was going to be interested in only black and white pictures of Van Gogh, because Van Gogh is all about color. I mean, well, not all, but color is a big thing in it. And of course they were right, but so they only give us black and white. So despite the fact that I only have a gray level, and so differences are gray level, I'm going to show them, I'm going to use false color to bring out different levels. So even though there's color here, it's not real information. So this is that first difference, a second one, and a third one. And if I put those next to each other, then things start standing out. For instance, this, which was the edge of the clog, is visible everywhere because there was a sharp edge and every blurring makes it a little blurrier, so that loss of information, that place of loss of information is found in all of them. But there are other places, like for instance this, if I enlarge this, then you see that at a very fine scale, there wasn't much. At an intermediate scale, something showed up, and at a larger scale, things disappeared again. So some features live at all scales, like edges. Other features live at some scales, intermediate scales, disappear. So what we did with this information was we actually, for all little fragments of the painting, we looked in many different directions. In all these directions, we looked at many scales, and we made a little statistic of what were, on the different directions, the places where things emerged and disappeared again, in scale-wise. So we made a statistic representation, a little table of numbers, so 110 numbers, more or less, of the information. And we can do, could then look at this collection of patches with their little feature vectors for one painting or for different paintings. And that would give us an idea of how dissimilar paintings were one from another. We could have, we had a distribution of vectors within a painting and then for a different painting. And so that gave us a way of defining a similarity or distance, if you want, for dissimilarity. Okay, and then I'd like to see here the first movie. Okay, so what we did here, what the, we'll have to see this movie a number of times. So what you see here is we had all these distances. Now, of course, the distances you get between every one of the paintings are presented by little thumbprints here is not something that corresponds to a 3D mobile of paintings. The distances are really, but what you can do is you can make the best three-dimensional representation of all those distances. But, and once we did that, because we had to explain this to art conservators, I mean, we made this virtual mobile. And we made it rotate so they would get a sense of it. And the center of gravity you see there, the paintings with a red dot, so we got something like 100 paintings, are the ones that among that collection were paintings that either had influenced Van Gogh a lot or had been paintings that at some point had been thought to be by Van Gogh. Some of those were paintings by Jean Bernard, who was a young painter who Van Gogh had befriended and who at some point early in his career painted similarly to Van Gogh, and they had swapped paintings. So there were, these paintings were in Van Gogh's possession when he died, but they were not by him, I mean, as was later shown, but originally they were thought to be by him. Other paintings, like a painting that is coming by, is going to become visible at the right, near the top, so it's the red dot there, yes, it comes to the forefront, is actually a 1930s forgery of Van Gogh's style by Wacker. So if we can do it again, yes. So one thing that's striking is that the paintings, the red paintings, are more towards the outside of this cloud than to the inside. So we had somehow captured style. On the other hand, the Wacker painting is not as close to the center as some other that are genuine Van Gogh paintings. So we haven't captured it completely. In fact, we can do better if we restrict ourselves to certain features of the feature vector. But okay, let's go back to the presentation. So that was the first thing that we did. But what was really interesting was that when I gave talks about this, people would say, oh, if you can do this, then maybe your tools could help us with that. And so this was the next thing that came out, which was what we like to call Lady 6 millimeters Under, which is a name that the art conservators and art curators hated. It's a painting by Van Gogh, underneath which, this is the painting, it's a painting of his Paris period. It's really a patch of grass horizontally, but if you put it vertical, like I first showed it, and you take, this is the X-ray of that, it had been known for a long time there was another painting underneath. Now, it's a portrait of a peasant woman, and it's not so surprising that there's something underneath. Actually, about 30% of Van Gogh's painting have another painting underneath, because canvas wasn't cheap, Van Gogh was poor, and so for all the paintings that he made in which he was trying to learn something new or try out something, once he felt he had learned it, he would reuse the canvas by putting a new layer of primer and painting something on top. And so having something underneath was not exceptional. What they were interested in for this painting was that it's a painting, the painting itself is from his Paris period, and the peasant portrait is from his Nuenen period, which is when he lived with his parents prior to going to Paris. And in that Nuenen period, he made many, many, many portraits of peasants, many of which have been preserved. So one more, you might think, what is that? But he also regularly wrote to his brother. We have an extensive correspondence between Vincent and Van Gogh, which has been complete, between Vincent and Theo Van Gogh, which has been completely preserved, and all for except a period in Paris when they lived together, so they could talk and they didn't have to write. And there's a letter from the Nuenen period, during which that was a period when he was experimenting with a very, very somber palette to try to nevertheless convey an impression of color. And so he writes to Theo, he says, I'm sending with this letter a painting in which I feel that I particularly well succeeded in this goal of rendering with the somber palette color. And we have the letter, but we don't have the painting. And this is a painting of the Paris period with a Nuenen thing underneath. So it's not unlikely that after having come to Paris, met the Impressionist, completely changing his style, he no longer valued that painting as much and would have reused it. And so because it was the one that he described as, that they believe described as particularly exemplary of his goals, people were interested in knowing more about it. So Koen Janssen and Joris Dick used, this was the first painting on which a now standard technique of X-ray fluorescence was used. So Koen Janssen is a material scientist. Joris Dick is both a material scientist and an art conservator. And they use a technique that's used for material science in order to find out what elements are present inside the painting. What you do is you use high enough energy X-rays that you completely ionize some materials, and they go back to neutrals by in two stages, and the transition between the higher and the lower state has a particular energy difference that characterizes the animals, and that you can measure from the frequency of the photon that gets sent out. It's fluorescence. And so by doing X-ray fluorescence, by measuring the spectrum at every different spot, they would get signature lines for different elements. And by the strength of a particular line for one element, you could see where it's more represented than where else. So here are two example maps, one for our scene, which was a component of the vermilion that Van Gogh was using. And indeed, you see it's strong in the lips. And one for antimony, which was a component of the only light pigment he was using in his palette, which is Naples yellow. And so in that Naples yellow, you see essentially the luminosity of the painting, because that was what he was using. There was no white on his palette for these paintings. So, and with that, they had done a reconstruction, which was here. Now, one thing you see here on the top right, you see a kind of zigzagging in these black spots. Well, what causes the black spots to begin with? On top was a painting of grass and blooms, and Van Gogh was using heavy impasto, and sometimes where he had a lot of paint, the X-rays hadn't been powerful enough to penetrate, and so you get no information. So that's the black spots. Why do you have these zigzag lines? The way this X-ray fluorescence for this thing was done was it had been taken from the museum with a hefty fee for insurance to a teaching hospital where they had a synchrotron that is a high powerful X-ray source. And this powerful X-ray source was used to make short-lived radioactive elements for medical testing. And whenever you have these costly things, they are financed by not only the medical tests, but when they're not used for their day job, the beam is directed in a different space for experiments, and experimental physicists help pay for the instrument by there. So they had rented some time on this experimental setup, and so the beam would be in their place, and it would illuminate a spot on the painting. The beam is always in the same place, and so this painting had to move every time they wanted to look at a different little pixel. Okay, the sled that was moving this had to be synced with whether the beam was there or not, because the beam would every so often have to do its day job, and would come back and so on, and all this happened automatically. And there was a synchronization error. And so since the scanning is done in zigzag like that, because of the synchronization error, it sometimes started taking measurements before or after and so on. And so you see that things that should have been one black spot get spread out. So there are little breaks everywhere. In order to make this picture, which they did with Photoshop, they corrected by hand some things, but they said, look, we know there are probably breaks in every line. We don't know how to find them automatically. We don't know what to do. Maybe you can help. And so indeed we could. And so that's the first thing we did. We got their data cube. And what we did is we made a Bayesian model for how was the likelihood of having breaks and so on. And we minimized variation, because this type of thing has a lot more variation than this. And so we did an iterative algorithm going back and forth over the image until we felt and we checked with them that indeed we had corrected for this. The next thing we did was we had all these black spots, but these are paintings. I mean, we know about many algorithms for impainting, but paintings, in fact, are much easier to impaint than spots that are removed from normal pictures, because you have brush strokes, and you see the brush stroke before and after, so you can. So we did that, and we first marked where they were, and then we corrected. We did a different impainting for the very long, stripy things that you saw from the grass. We marked them, and we marked them, and we impainted them. And once you knew how to impaint them, you could do the same algorithm on the whole data. You only had to find it on one data cube in order to correct everywhere. Next, we had a problem at the eyes. We said, what are we going to do there? And the conservator said, oh, we always use the other eye, because that's what painters do. They try to paint both eyes the same way, because otherwise it looks really weird. We said, well, we can do that. So we did. So we now have, and here you see the effect of removing those black spots very nicely. I mean, it's done very, very, very smoothly. And so doing that, we
felt we could get color in. But color, we didn't have in the data cube all the information. We had no information about the earth colors, which give which fluoresce in a completely different part of the spectrum, or we had no information about blues. So we didn't really have the full information. However, what we found was that if we look at other paintings by Van Gogh in the same time, two examples of which are here, a one with the lowest contrast we could find on internet and one with the highest. And if you decompose those, I mean, so you can do decompose color pictures in RGB, but you can also look at luminance and then place on the color wheel, chromance and saturation. So if you look at place on the color wheel, you get this, which looks very different. But remember, where it's really black, you have no information. The thing just tries to put. So let's remove that black. You get this. And they look remarkably similar. Similar enough that with information like this and the partial information on color we had, we could infer other colors and then bring color back to the other image. So in the end, what we got was this. So we went from this coloration to the one on the right, which gives a much better impression. And so people really like this. So we had been working on projects of this type when I moved to Duke, and I got in touch with people at the North Carolina Museum of Art there. And actually, we were working and still are working on a project involving paintings by Giotto when they told me about, over coffee, about a different problem. And that was this one. So they have an other altarpiece of about the same age as Giotto, but by a much less famous painter, Francescuccio Guizzi, from the Marche region in Italy, of which they have three panels. In the, I believe the 1970s, it had been discovered that these were three panels of an altarpiece, of which other panels were in different American collections. There's one that is in Portland, three that are the Metropolitan Museum of Art, one that is in Chicago in the Art Institute. There's one that's missing. It had been discovered by stylistic similarities that these all belong to the same altarpiece. And the art historian at the museum in Raleigh, who had found this out, had dreamed of making an exhibit where they would all be reunited. And the other museums had not been that interested because they said, there's one missing anyway. I mean, he tried to find it in the collection, but we don't know. It might have disappeared. It might be in some private collection where somebody doesn't pay attention to what's going on and hasn't seen that there's a search for this one. What happened is that this whole altarpiece, which was on one big piece of wood, was dismembered when the church was decommissioned at the end of the 19th century, because that was a time when collectors in America started to be interested in these paintings. And although you can get more as a dealer for one big altarpiece than for small panels, you get much more for nine small panels than for one big altarpiece. So typically, many of these paintings have been dismembered, and they went their different ways, and we don't know where the last one is. But I, through the work with the Van Gogh Museum, I had met Charlotte Kaspers, who's a very, very talented painter in her own right, but she also is a fantastically well-trained and talented art reconstruction expert. And here you see her making a reconstruction of a painting by Hieronymus Bosch. So museums are interested in these for many educational purposes. I mean, you can let kids, I mean, they like to involve young people in museums. There's no way you can let them handle or even stay very close to an authentic Bosch. But a reconstruction that's done in authentic ways, authentic pigments, authentic techniques and so on, by a contemporary artist is something that, while valuable, is not of the same inestimable value as Van Bosch, and so they can be centerpieces for educational experiences. So that's one reason. In any case, they commissioned her to paint that a missing panel. Now, it's one thing to make a very authentic looking copy with traditional means of an existing painting. Here you have a painting that you don't have. So how are you going to do that? Well, the original painting, the small panels, recount the life of John the Evangelist. Not only that, but they recount it in detail, following exactly the scenes as they are described in the Golden Legend, a book that is a hagiography from the Middle Ages, so Life of Saints. That must have been a real bestseller, because there are so many books of which we only have fragments, but of this they have a zillion copies. So everybody seems to have had a copy, so it was a very well-known book. And so they could figure out what the missing scene was. They knew it was the last scene. And so they made a composition for that last scene that looked like it's the baptism of an archpriest of you see here in the top right scene is a time when the archpriest has challenged John the Baptist. He says, "I don't believe in your God." He says, "I'm going to pray that my goddess destroys your church," and he prays and nothing happens. And then John the Baptist prays for the heathen thing to destroy and it falls in pieces. And then the one but last scene at the bottom is a scene where he says, "Well, if your God is so powerful, can you will he let you drink poison and not be hurt?" And so he actually drinks poison that was used to kill to execute two criminals, and he drinks the dregs of the poison cup and he's unharmed. And after that, the guy says, "Okay, I believe." And he lets himself be baptized. And so they made something that used elements of the other paintings, because they didn't want to invent new compositions to paint that, to make that scene. And here you see her painted. And this was the glorious result at the end. It was extraordinary. They made a documentary of her painting this. And so that documentary was shown at the exhibit. But it was beautiful, because for all the paints she used the traditional pigments. They had been analyzed in the other paintings, the traditional techniques. It's absolutely beautiful. And it's then that they realized they had a problem. Because putting it next to this new painting was going to give an extraordinary image of how the painting must have looked like when it was new. I mean, this gold was burnished. You cannot do that with the paintings now. But they had a problem. If they put it next to the others, it would just be too different. And people wouldn't even look at the old ones, because the other new one was so bright and nice. But then I said, well, mathematics can help. Mathematics can always help. Mathematics can help. Since we have studied the whole thing, we can find the correspondence between old and new pigments, and we can take a high-resolution copy and age it. And that's what was done. In the we found the color correspondences, cracks, we aged the gold leaf work, and that printout was displayed at the exhibit. And here. And it was, it actually shows a little bit more here, because the printing ink was not completely opaque, and the paper had changed a little bit during the 6 months of the exhibition. This was taken at the very end of the exhibition, so there's a slight difference in color, but it was less so at the start of the year. And it really fooled people. I mean, you had to look closely. I mean, not enough to really fool them. I mean, if you looked 2 minutes, then you saw one was printed and the other was painted. But it gave this homogeneous look, which people wanted. And they also displayed the painting. But we then also realized, since we now could age virtually, we could rejuvenate the other ones virtually. Now, for that, we had to do something the color correspondence, yes. What we had to do was we had to find all the cracks and remove them, because when it was new, there were no cracks. And we had to make the gold look authentic and new. So crack finding was something I knew we could do. I knew because we had done it before. We had done it on a very, very famous painting, the Van Eyck altarpiece. If you close that painting, it's a polyptych, so it has doors that can close. There is a scene here on the right in the middle that has a book in the background. Well, of course, it's not a book. It's a painting of a book. And this book intrigued people because they couldn't read the text. Now, I can't read books like that in a museum when I see the original book, but experts, of course, can. But they couldn't read this. And they couldn't read it, and they were interested in reading it because many experts thought, well, of course, this is just a painting. He put some squiggles that look like letters, but they're not letters. And others thought, no, we really believe these are true letters. And if they are, we'd like to identify the text because it may mean something, because Van Eyck was a great perfectionist. And I said, but why can't you read it? I mean, there are letters there. I can't read them. But he said, well, no. He said, the cracks really prevent us. The cracks, it's impossible for us to think away cracks. In our, we can many do many things with our vision, but thinking away things like that, we can't. And I said, well, if it's that, then maybe we can help. And in fact, it was much tougher than I thought. But we learned how to do it. We learned how to make a crack map. I mean, and it's hard because you see it's the same browns as the letters. And but we learned how to do this. We learned to make a good distinction between crack pixels and painting pixels. And then we could mark them and inpaint. And then when I first saw the result of the inpainting, I thought, well, fat lot of good that has done. I mean, it's just as illegible as before. But it wasn't to experts. They could now recognize groups of letters which were sufficient for them to believe that they have identified the book, which was a book that had a chapter on the Annunciation. So they're really very excited about it. But work is ongoing in trying to make that more watertight. In any case, so I knew we could find cracks. So here, again, on the Gissi, we do a crack detection, and then we can inpaint them. We can do that. We do that via an iterative algorithm, you see, gradually. We don't go as far as we could go. We stop when we believe that we might try to go too far. So it's not perfect, but we worked very closely. In all these things, we worked very closely with the art historians and the art conservators to work in a justifiable manner according to their field. Okay, so color remapping. We had old colors and new colors, so we could use that. Gold we'll come back to. We could use that to go to from the old to rejuvenated colors, or from the new fresh colors on the right to aged colors. We could introduce cracks for the virtually aged thing. The one thing, so this was the printout that we used for the exhibit, but in order to rejuvenate the older panels, we also had to rejuvenate the gold. You see, all that gold, the gold background, was put down by the painter and then punched with punch marks. And so you see the whole thing would be burnished, so it was gleaming. It must have been wonderful in these churches when they were new, with the reflection of the candles on these paintings. And then you see how the punch marks showed up as a much lighter surroundings on the new paintings, whereas they became old and cracked and full of dirt on the older paintings. So in order to do that, we had to find on each of the old paintings all the punch marks, and we took that information and used that to then model. So now we get into rendering. I mean, in order to get an idea of gold reflections, you really have to move your head, especially on something flat, something that's curved. Your brain actually looks at, sees these reflections and reconstructs it. It must be a gleaming, but a flat object is much harder. So you do get that impression by moving your head slightly. And so we did that for these paintings, and we used computer graphics techniques to get them. And so I'd like to go to a piece of the second movie. So we made for the exhibit this movie that was shown there on a big screen on what rejuvenated. And you'll see how the punch marks show up and how the reflections move. And so the exhibit gave the reunited panel, then one wall with the authentic, with the new reconstructed thing and an explanation of all the materials that were used. A third wall had a documentary of making that. And then a final wall showed this on a large screen, together with small videos and interviews of the students who had worked on this. All this rejuvenation work had been done by undergrads over a program that lasted 6 months and on which they worked very hard and for which they got recognition. They thought it was absolutely wonderful, of course, and it was. And in the final non-existing minute of my talk, you can find out much about this whole project if you go to a website that's called Duke IPAI, so Duke like the university where I am, and then in one word, IPAI, together with the Duke, Image Processing for Art Investigation. So dukeipai.org, and from there you can go to different projects, and this is there. So let's go to the next slide. We have, this is, until now I've been talking about image processing and many different aspects. We have recently, I mean, this is the latest challenge on which we're working, and we only recently, a month ago, got good results on it. This is Ghent altarpiece again. These doors, some of them have been cut into two pieces so that you have the two paintings, and that has different challenges. But some of them are still planks with paintings on both sides, like Adam and this interior scene. When you x-ray a painting like that, you see both paintings together. Art conservators really like to see x-rays of paintings for many reasons. When they see the superposition of the two paintings together, it's very hard again for them to read that. And they said, can you separate those? Can you, given the two visibles, separate superposition of the x-rays into what the individual x-rays would look like if only one of them were painted on the thing? And it turned out that's surprisingly hard. I mean, over the past couple of years, we've written a number of papers where we achieved partial results, but we recently got really to do it. Here's another one where you have both. So here you see on this painting, you see both the folds of the figure of the prophet and the face of Eve coming through. And here you see the face of Adam and folds of another figure. And what we can do now, so this is what we could do with previous techniques, and you see how the eye of Adam still comes through and so on. And this is what we can do now. And we're very, very happy with this. But we also, like many people in other people using neural nets, kind of frustrated because we use the neural net for doing this and we don't really know what the neural net is doing. But it's doing this, it can do it. And that's where we'll stop today.
Let's entertain a few questions. Anyone? Yes.
So I know, I guess Europe is filled with a bunch of prayers. They have some pygmies and a bunch of paintings that were painted earlier. Now that there's a big push to remove the pygmies.
Okay, so the question was, in many paintings in Europe have nudes, on which at other periods veils or fig leaves have been painted in strategic places, and there's now a push to remove those. Have I been involved with that? So yes and no. So I have not been involved in actual removal, virtual removal of these fig leaves. In many of these cases, they remove them physically. I mean, they actually go back in a restoration campaign to the early stages. Adam and Eve that you saw here, actually, the only reason we have Adam and Eve on the original plank on both sides is that in the 19th century, when all the other planks were sawn vertically for display of the paintings, they wanted to display the paintings side by side, not on the doors. They didn't do that with Adam and Eve because Adam and Eve were too naked. They had copies painted with appropriate fig leaves, and those were displayed, and the true Adam and Eve were just against the wall. So that's why those splitting paintings like that has its own problems. It really hurts the integrity of the paintwork, so it's something that's not done anymore now. But we could do this virtually if people wanted to, but in most cases people are now wanting to move to see, to get the original. So it's something for which there doesn't seem to be demand.
If you did that operation, it would be called a modesty transform and the inverse thereof.
Absolutely.
Other questions? Yes.
Oh, I'm all for it, but I'm also all for help trying to understand what they do. Look, for many of the tasks for which neural nets aren't successful now, people have used for a long time ways of achieving those goals. And we are now in a situation where neural nets do, via their internal magic, achieve results that we couldn't obtain earlier. But so this gives us, I view it as a fantastic opportunity, because on the one hand, yes, we want those goals. It's a little bit like the machine that plays Go. I mean, Go players are entranced. I mean, it has changed the way in which humans at a very high level play Go, because they see different approaches to the game that they hadn't seen before. And similarly, I think we're going to discover different approaches to reach these goals that we hadn't seen before. And that is interesting. But it's also interesting to try to understand how the algorithms that we are using get to these results. And once we understand how they get there, we'll be able to do much more. I mean, of that I'm convinced. So I think it's a fantastic challenge and opportunity. And for something for which mathematical thinking will be absolutely essential.
I have one more question on it.
Yes.
So you have been developing a lot of these cool mathematical techniques that is about R. You try using for CT scans, MRI scans, to detect, diagnose.
So certainly. I have been involved also I'm still involved in using techniques for analyzing medical signals and so on. For CT scans, a lot of serious mathematics has been used for quite a while. A big revolution came for MRI scans when people understood that sparsity of the signal representation can really help, and that's when you got compressed sensing and so on. So it's an area in which there has been much more of an input of mathematics for a much longer time, and new ways of new mathematical paradigms and so on have continued to have an impact there. It was more surprising for this art conservation and so on, and still now when I talk to conservators, they're always, I mean, once I explain what I do to a technical audience, they say, oh yes, this is great. But very often the problems are not off-the-shelf problems. You can't take an off-the-shelf technique and apply it. They have their own challenges and so on. A different thing which I didn't talk about, the paintings that were on two sides of a panel and the planks were sawn, very often at that time the planks were made much thinner. And then they put a hardwood lattice on the back to give it more integrity again. That hardwood, when you x-ray it, shows up incredibly. I mean, so it's very hard to use the x-rays of these things. So we have developed algorithms to remove it, but we can remove not only these differences in luminosity, but we can also remove the wood grain of the hardwood and retain the wood grain of the original panel. That's something they asked us. I said, well, that won't be possible. It turned out with some machine learning, old-fashioned machine learning, not neural nets, we could do that, so where we understand what we're doing. And so these are challenges. That was a source separation channel that was completely different from anything else. So they provide interesting challenges that we can translate into mathematical problems and then approach mathematical and signal processing. So we are seeing the emergence of a new application field of mathematics and signal processing techniques, which I think is great. But it's also great in that it brings a link with students in the humanities. I now am working with an undergrad at Duke who is majoring and continues to want to major in art history and art conservation. But through working with this, she has realized that it would be so good for her to learn more computer science. She's going to have a double major, computer science and art history. She's learning all this computer stuff and signal processing stuff. She will work this summer with people at UCL in London and at National Gallery. And I think it's the beginning of a new breed. I mean, as we do more technology, it's good that students with whose major intellectual interests are in the humanities acquire those techniques, that we don't see a schism in people who can and people who can't. I mean, some of them have the wish to learn and the skills to learn and will learn and still apply it to those fields. And I think that's great.
Other questions?
Well, sure. I mean, I'm sure that at some very fine scales, we go to things where they didn't consciously control everything. I mean, Aldo van Eyck, I mean, he's known to have painted things with brushes that had one hair in them. I mean, it's not done very much anymore these days. But but that's not, what we do very much as building tools to approach, to understand, to and so on. But the main person, I mean, the pursuit is typically driven in our case by the art conservator or the art curator. I mean, and we very closely work with them because they have all the domain knowledge. I don't believe in trying to use automatic tools to reconstruct approximately a domain knowledge that they already have in much better degree anyway. We work with them and we work on questions that they find of interest. Or I may sometimes say, look, in this case, would it be of interest to you if we could do that, if I can see something that we could do? And sometimes I say yes and sometimes I say no. I'm not going to waste energy. I mean, there's enough problems in the world to do that are of interest. I mean, shouldn't be working on things that it's like trying to write difficult differential equations that nobody cares about and learn how to solve them. That doesn't make any sense. I mean, they did that at some point, but doesn't make any sense anymore. I mean, but on the other hand, the things that are of interest to them can have really interesting challenges to us, and they may be interested only in the result. But the challenges in solving those challenges then is something that is a knowledge and an approach that we can use in many other pursuits. And,
I have one question. That beautiful fresco that you started your lecture with, where you introduced the circular harmonics as a mm-hmm. representation of the image to do the matching. One question occurred to me, and I'm sure you solved it, but is when you take your chip of the fresco and you do the circular harmonic transform to that, and it's beautiful because it's rotationally invariant, as mm-hmm. I understand, but the scale, when you do your digitized reference versus this, the chip, there's a scale issue there, and you had to address that.
Yes, so what happens is that as you look at the circle that you have on the fragment,
yes.
You then search with a circle of that size on the database. But so what they had is they first decomposed the digital information on the black and white by a convolution with that circle, and they had so, and they did not, of course, they didn't have a continuum, but they had things that were close enough that they could easily interpolate.
And because you had the photograph to begin with, once you took care of parallax, you knew the scale.
Yes. And they had decomposed that at different scales, mm-hmm. and they interpolated for intermediate scales.
Wonderful. I think we'll stop here and give a please Please stay with me. It's Christmas in April. And we have here a very nice memento for your bookshelf.
Thank you.
It's a piece of crystal that I think. So congratulations again.
Thank you.
We really appreciate this wonderful job you did on this lecture.
Thank you.
One very final housekeeping item. The students who are here, who are honor students, I can see there's several in the front row here. Please register before you leave the building, to get your credit. Thank you all very much. We have a reception outside, I think.